Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as the battle space of the war for the free world. One of those who is chronicling it, trying to make sense of it, and teaching others about his insights is Dr. Henry Now. He is a professor of political science and international affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Also has been a fellow at the marvelous Hoover Institution in California, and served a long time ago, back when men were men, I like to think of, on President Reagan's National Security Council. Henry Now, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Listen, I want to visit with you and get sort of your perspective, both as a practitioner and as now an academic, on what the debate last night between President Obama and Mitt Romney illuminated, if anything, with respect to their views on foreign and defense policy, which was the putative focus of that debate.
Yeah, I think the best you can say is that the debate sort of got the subject out of the way. It's
check the box.
Yeah, exactly. It isn't clearly the subject on which this election turns, and I thought Romney was strongest when he was able to relate the fact that we can't have a foreign policy of any consequence as long as we are as weak internally as we are, both economically and militarily, and I would have liked him to come back to that more and more often. And Mr. President, you talk about our influence in the world and so on. How in the world can we have any influence in the world when we are, you know, in this kind of a situation domestically?
Now, that's interesting. I actually thought that they did rather too much of that myself, but I was hoping for more of a real joining of some of the issues that we, you know, anticipate are going to feature in the next Commander-in-Chief's role.
That was calculated. I mean, to Romney's credit, perhaps, he sees that the American people are not going to be swayed, and certainly the undecided are not going to be swayed on this election, primarily in terms of foreign policy. The country's war-weary. That's too bad. I don't like that, because when we get into these moods, we make all sorts of mistakes, like we did after Vietnam, and we're very likely to do that again, I fear. But he was trying to avoid putting himself in a position where Obama could could easily make him out to be a trigger happy. And I wish he had. What he should have done is he should have kind of drawn the link between our declining influence in the world and Obama's relations with Russia and China. For example, he never mentioned that these two countries support Iran, and Iran, we're trying to sanction Iran. We're trying to get Iran, the president's whole policy is based on trying to get Iran to change course. Well, the two countries that he's cozying up to, China and Russia, they're the ones who keep Iran alive. They're the ones who keep Assad alive in Syria. He didn't mention that. He didn't mention that the Soviets, that the very people with whom Obama is saying that he's going to be more flexible after the election, they are arming the Assad government. They are protecting their military, their naval bases in the Mediterranean. They have now troops permanently stationed in Georgia. Russia is clearly extending its influence in Ukraine, increasingly now through manipulating the whole gas transport and supply issue. So that's what he should have done. Now, none of that means that he would have put himself in a position where Obama would have said, well, you're talking about putting ground troops in there. And he said, no, Mr. President, I'm not. But I'm talking about the fact that unless America is out there leading in the world, not from behind, we cannot shape these events, and these events are moving against our interests.
Yeah.
That was a little disappointing.
Yeah, no, I felt that same way. Dr. Henry Now is our guest. You almost certainly heard him, President Obama, say, and certainly the postmortem has been playing this clip, that he castigated Mr. Romney for having, even as much as he did, policies that were sort of throwbacks to the 1980s and the Cold War, and again, back at a time when that we in fact, I think you alluded to the Soviets, and of course they're the Russians now, but they're behaving in a manner that is very reminiscent in some ways of Putin's formative years under the Soviet Union. To the extent that the president was trying to sound like Mitt Romney when it came to issues like the strength of our military, as he made a very flat commitment that you know, he was committed to having the strongest military in the world, and that you know, sequestration, this round of budget cuts that's looming, is not going to happen, and so on. He was clearly trying to blur the differences as much as Romney seemed to be trying to on some of the other issues, notably this democracy project in the Middle East.
That's absolutely right. He potentially made, I think, a statement that will come back to haunt him if he's reelected, because the odds are that he is not unhappy with sequestration, since it does pretty much what he wants. It cuts defense, it raises taxes, all of the things that he wants. So he may have put himself in a bind there. But again, the only strategy Obama has had in the entire campaign is to try to link Romney with the Bush-Cheney economic policies and the Bush-Cheney foreign policies. Now, I was also disappointed that Romney didn't hark back a little more to the Reagan era. I mean, he could have said, you know, look, Ronald Reagan didn't fire a shot because he didn't have to. People knew he would if they crossed him. He built up this country, and then he had a very ambitious diplomatic program that eventually brought the Soviet Union around. But it would not have happened without his challenge to the Soviet Union, you know, throwing down the gauntlet, saying, if you want to go in, you know, down the road of an arms race, you can't beat us. It's that kind of peace through strength that makes the difference. I mean, I wish he'd hark back to that. I don't know why Reagan is being you know, obscured by the Republican Party. I most of what I read during this campaign doesn't make enough about of the legacy that Ronald Reagan left for the Republican Party. He was strong.
I'd like to explore that with you.
But he never had to use his weapons.
Yeah.
And that's the whole point.
Yeah. Henry, now, you are, of course, a serious scholar of these matters, as well as, I mentioned earlier, a man who is among the Reagan alumni. Perspectives on international relations, power, institutions, and ideas, for example, one of your recent books. This is a question that I'm vexed by a lot, and I would love to explore with you. My sense of it is that we've had kind of a lost generation when it comes to national security. We didn't, of course, lose them in a terrible war, as in the lost generation after World War I, for example. But we've lost, in a sense, the knowledge, the corporate memory of those Reagan years, in the sense that a great many Republicans and conservatives among them have simply stopped thinking about these issues with the fall of the Cold War. I wonder if you would, you know, speak to that question.
It's a huge failing on our part, and I hope that we see it in the next decade. In other words, we don't fight this battle of legacy the way our liberal friends do. I was making that point out at the Hoover Institution, which is one of the oases, one of the small sort of centers of, you know, academic work trying to nurture these legacies of successful foreign policy from a conservative perspective. I've just completed a book manuscript coming out next year called Conservative Internationalism.
Good.
And the whole effort is to try to show, look, this is more than neoconservatism. It includes neoconservatism, but it really includes a much broader way of thinking about both domestic and foreign policy. Nobody has quite done it the way Ronald Reagan did. I have a full chapter in this book on Ronald Reagan, and the next book I've just started on will deal with Ronald Reagan, because he seemed to have this secret. Two key, or maybe three key points that he always kept in mind. One was, you have to pursue your foreign policy in order to advance the cause of freedom. You cannot just be interested in stability. That was his big problem with the Kissinger, Nixon people, and with the policy of containment under Kissinger and Nixon. Secondly, you must be strong, but you also must have a policy that can eventually provide your adversary with a way out through negotiations. You use your strength to prevent your adversary from getting his objectives outside the negotiations. Then you use your diplomacy to create an alternative inside the negotiations that your adversary can't refuse. And in the end, Reagan had that idea for the Soviets. Let's move to a more humane system of deterrence. That was his idea of mutual shared defensive missile technology. And come and join us in the global economy. Yep. The information age is underway. We want you guys to be a part of it. The Chinese
Henry,
are part of it.
We have to let you go. I'm afraid this is a critical reminder of how it could be done and should be done. I hope we will see the next president applying these lessons. Thank you for your insights here today and at the George Washington University.
Thank you, Frank. Keep up the good work.
You too, and we'll talk with you again soon, I hope. Next up, Diana West joins us. We'll take stock of the election campaign and the debate last night with one of the best in the business. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, that adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
You'll be your best friend for life.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by the fabulous Diana West, our friend and colleague, a member of our Team B2 group that published Sharia, the Threat to America, also the author of Death of the Grown-Up and the author of innumerable superb columns. She is currently a syndicated columnist and a pundit of the first order. And welcome back, Diana West. It's always great to have you with us.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
So we're talking about postmortems on this election and what one makes of it. I want to talk specifically about Benghazi Gate and why it seemed not to feature in it. But talk a bit, or probably really, talk about your more general impressions, if you would.
Yes, well, it was, you know, on one level, crashingly disappointing to see Mitt Romney fail to advance a cogent foreign policy. On another level, I see a strategy having played out that I hope works, because the most important thing, of course, is that President Obama not be reelected. And I think what you saw there was the soft, presidential, pleasant, confident figure making pretty images on the screen in order to perhaps win over some of these final undecided voters. And I think that in a sense this was theater more than debate.
To the extent that it featured prominently in the previous debate, did you feel that Mitt Romney was pulling his punches a bit when the lead question from Bob Schieffer was about the Libyan escapade and the follow-up to it, the cover-up to it?
Yes, absolutely. Because even if the conversation had drifted or moved in another direction, if I had been on that stage, I would have wanted to grab for my Benghazi at every possible moment rather than going back into, you know, some of the boilerplate on the economy and so on. But obviously, this was a strategic decision. This was not the kind of debate where they seriously were discussing images in terms of reality. You had a number of whoppers coming from Obama, whether it was about that he had nothing to do with the idea of sequestration, you know, that he hadn't gone on an apology tour, and fact checkers had proved this. I mean, there were absolute lunatic statements coming out of his mouth, and Romney, on his part, was not pressing any of the incredible weaknesses to be pressed in the Obama policy, because as you and I have discussed, I strongly feel that Benghazi is merely almost a strange way, a fortunate event, in not obviously having to do with any of the actual killing and destruction and harm that's done to our country, but in the sense of grabbing people's attention so that we can understand exactly what's wrong with the American Arab Spring policy that Obama has been executing. In a sense, that was what I would have wanted in a Republican nominee, to use Benghazi as a teaching tool, taking it down the line, whether it's presidential lies, administration lies, whether it's security failure, and whether it's the sort of the Uber theme, the failure of supporting jihad, Muslim Brotherhood, actors across the Middle East, and how it comes back to bite you every time.
Yeah. You have written brilliantly about this and with great regularity at, among other places, DianaWest.net. I encourage you to make this a bookmark, a favorite must-read each day. Diana, specifically, you've been addressing a couple of different issues, and I want, in the little time we have with you today, to sort of touch on them. Against the backdrop of the failed opportunity to do a teachable moment, as the president likes to say last night, what we do, nonetheless, need to be thinking about as we head to the polls 2 weeks from today, specifically the condition of our security in light of the now burgeoning phenomenon of ascendant Islamism. I think Mitt Romney actually used the term jihadism last night, which I was so much heartened by, and did talk about the need for a comprehensive strategy for countering it. If you were advising him, Diana West, what would you be counseling he be doing, if not between now and November 6th, should he win immediately thereafter?
Specifically regarding the military?
Well, let's start with the larger strategy towards the jihadists that are now on the rise and on the march throughout the Middle East.
Oh, well, step one, he would sit down for a briefing with Stephen Coughlin to understand that jihad is a doctrine that is supported, documented, promoted, the lifeblood itself of all of classical Islamic teaching. That would be the first thing he needs to understand, because he made several calls last night about the importance to somehow teach the Islamic world to reject extremism, which again is almost an Obama-esque sense of having a role within Islam. And I think that that is absolutely the wrong direction. This is more about how to protect our liberty rather than help an Islamic world accept our liberty, which really is what's gotten us into so much trouble for the past decade. I think that it underlies both the Bush policy and the Obama policy. I think that the abandonment of the whole notion of doing sort of secular missionary work, if you will, through counterinsurgency operations, which again kind of is the manifestation of the same notion that you can go out there into the Islamic world and introduce Western norms, because that is essentially what drives these vast effort. The way we've done it, of course, has been to accept Islamic norms and to bring them into our military, which you and I have talked about at length. So there has to be really an absolute halt to every institutional notion that has been driving post 9/11 policy from Bush to Obama.
Yeah.
And I think that it begins with an understanding of the differences between an Islamic culture and what it prizes and values, and a Western culture and what it prizes and values, and figure out how coexistence is possible, but also how it is possible not to be co-opted.
And forced to submit, as you've described it, this dimitude phenomenon. Diana West, just quickly, on the military, again, you have been really reporting, I think, as well as anyone, on what is happening to the armed forces of the United States. You know, there was a lot of talk about it last night. Mitt Romney was, reinforcing his general proposition that peace through strength is the way to go, as it has been in the past. Mitt Romney's debating partner was trying to sound more like Mitt Romney on some of these points than Mitt. President Obama committing himself to a military second to none, and so on. But what's actually happening, as you see it, both with respect to the material condition of our armed forces and, well, the more intangible, perhaps, but no less important, moral and morale condition of our military as well?
Well, I think they're both in shambles. I think, you know, after 10 years of fighting, obviously your systems and your personnel are physically degraded or strained is perhaps a better word, particularly in regard to the personnel. But I think the moral question really is the more important question, because from what I hear from my sources and also my military readers, is I don't know if the word is cynicism or just absolute sense of betrayal when it comes to what the military is pressing on them from above in terms of these sensitivity trainings, these counterinsurgency operations, this dimification that they are actually having to undergo, which of course has gone to the point of a spate of murders by our supposed allies of our own personnel. They have a loss of trust with the brass, with the senior leadership in the military. And the only way to cure such a thing is, again, to go back to some kind of frank assessment of what our position in the world is vis-a-vis expansionist Islam. And I think that is something that has been glossed over since 9/11 and has resulted in all of these tremendously failed policies and ill use, misuse of our people. And this is a great shame that in a presidential debate on foreign policy, the actual troops are not mentioned, are not discussed as something that the next president wants to make amends for after all this time.
We hope that in the remaining weeks of this campaign, and certainly in the days that follow it, there will be opportunity for both that kind of making of amends and corrective action, and that you will have a hand in shaping both, Diana West, at the very least, in terms of clarification of what needs to be done. Thank you so much for taking some time with us today. For your great work, Diana West, syndicated columnist. Check her out at dianawest.net. Next up, we'll be talking with Ted Bromont of the Heritage Foundation about the United Nations. Why didn't they figure in last night's debate? Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you.
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In 90 minutes of debate last night, the presidential candidates seemed mostly to be trying to sound like one another. President Obama wanted the audience to think of him as committed, as his rival, to a strong American military, a secure Israel, and a nuclear-free Iran. For his part, Governor Romney showed little disagreement with Mr. Obama on his handling of Afghanistan, his conduct of the war on terror, and his effort to bring democracy to the Mideast. And both men clearly preferred to use the occasion to talk about the importance of our economic strength, even though they do differ on how to increase it, rather than the fine points of national security. It may come down to this. Do you feel safer today than 4 years ago? I, for one, do not. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Welcome back. We're joined by Ted Bromont. He is one of the leading lights at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., where he is a senior research fellow in the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. Ted is one of those guys who covers a part of the foreign and defense policy portfolio that is particularly aggravating, I must say, in terms of the role that the United Nations is increasingly being allowed to play in matters that touch on, if not trample upon, our sovereignty. And Ted, I'm delighted to have you back. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk about both sort of your take on the debate and the almost complete absence of any discussion of the UN in its course and kind of where we are today.
Thanks, Frank. Really good to be with you and your listeners. As you just remarked, it's very strange that except for a very passing mention by Governor Romney in the course of the debate over Syria, the UN really didn't arise at all. And this is very strange because President Obama came into office expressing his enthusiasm for working through and with the United Nations. He's made speeches there that, at least rhetorically, were very impressive, very strong speeches. His administration has committed to negotiating a number of treaties and ratifying a number of treaties that were made under UN auspices. And in all of these things, Governor Romney has expressed skepticism, in some cases rather excoriating skepticism. So you would think that the UN and the broader and even more fundamental issue of American sovereignty would have come up in this debate. But except for the brief, very passing mention by the governor, the entire question of the UN, the entire fundamental question of U.S. sovereignty was really conspicuous by its absence.
Yeah. We've been talking throughout the show about the extent to which, you know, a sort of tactic Governor Romney evidently embraced was, you know, sort of trying not to be too confrontational in many of these regards, and I guess maybe this is one on which he would have almost certainly have had to have been confrontational. But Ted, talk to us a little bit about some of these treaties, because what I've been struck by is the extent to which it seems as though the progressive left, the transnational left, whatever you want to call it, has been rather assiduously trying to use them as a means of kind of circumventing the normal constitutional process for changing the laws of the United States. Am I right about that?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's become crystal clear that it's extraordinarily difficult for the left to persuade the U.S. Senate under any conceivable political configuration to ratify the kinds of treaties that it would really like to see ratified. It would like to see things like rights of the child, Convention on the Rights of Women, et cetera, et cetera. These things are very difficult, and it's even more difficult, of course, to get the Senate and the House to pass laws to this effect. So what the administration, and really what the broader progressive left is trying to do, is trying to get treaties that are negotiated, that are signed, that can then be smuggled in via the back door, via judicial interpretation, via administrative action, via the creation of international norms, so-called, that then become a way for the U.S. Constitution to be reinterpreted. One that I followed very closely, and I know you followed it very closely too, is the U.N. Arms Trade Treaty, where we won a temporary victory in July, but it's only a temporary victory when the U.N. negotiating conference was unable to come into a final agreement on a text. But we will get another negotiating conference in the spring on the Arms Trade Treaty. And I would be shocked at that point if we did not get a final treaty coming out of that. If we have an Obama administration, I think the administration will sign the treaty. If we have a Romney administration, I would be very doubtful if the U.S. even participates in the negotiations, never mind signing the treaty. But that one is still floating around out there. Of course, we have the Law of the Sea Treaty, where I think for a while we've won a victory. The letter of Senator Lee discouraging the administration from submitting any treaties during the lame duck session provides some very important cover on that subject. But all of these treaties, Law of the Sea, CEDAW, Rights of the Child, the Arms Trade Treaty when it comes to fruition, all these treaties are what I like to call zombie treaties. It's almost Halloween, so maybe that's an appropriate reference.
Yes, indeed it is.
They never die.
They never die. They keep coming back. Before we run out of time, let me bring you back, Ted Broman, because I think you've done such incredibly important work on this arms trade treaty. It is one of the most sweeping, I think it's fair to say, efforts to interfere with everything from our individual right to bear arms to the kind of support we could provide our allies in terms of military hardware and assistance. It really seems unbelievable that this would not be provoking more of a focused conversation, maybe in the debate last night or among the public. Is it simply that people don't have a clue what's afoot here? Is it something that is, as is often done, kind of behind closed doors in the UN and therefore largely shielded from public scrutiny? What is going on here, Ted Broman?
I think there are a couple of factors. First, you actually have to read treaties and follow negotiations to understand them. These are technical matters, and I quite understand why a lot of people don't want to spend their time doing this, including in the media. Second, the U.S. broadly based tends to trust the president in foreign affairs, whoever the president is. So naturally, President Obama benefits from that. And third, I think to an extent, since the U.S. is already very skeptical of the United Nations generally, it tends to sort of mentally write it off and say, oh, that's just the U.N. Nothing much is going to happen there. We know it's a useless talking shop. We know it's stuffed full of anti-Americans and dictators and international criminals. So therefore, let's just not pay it any mind. And I understand that sentiment totally, but I don't completely share it. because unfortunately, even though the UN does have far too many dictators and anti-Americans in it, it unfortunately still does matter, and it still unfortunately can do us some harm. So I think to an extent, the United States is ill-served by its dislike for the UN, because it encourages us to treat it with too little attention.
Yeah, well, and as you understand so well, Ted Broman, senior research fellow at the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation, just because we are contemptuous of the outfit doesn't mean that, especially with our considerable largesse in underwriting its operations, that these kinds of activities don't actually have a material impact on us. And I want to come back to this point that you made in two respects. One, this notion of creating, even if we're not party to these treaties, even if in the end the Senate says thanks but no thanks, there are nonetheless these international norms created and judges who are willing to impose them, it appears, on the one hand. And there's also something called the Vienna Convention on Treaties, which I'd like you to explain, if you would, whereby even if the Senate hasn't been asked to ratify a treaty, as I understand it, the president's signature on it binds us effectively to conforming to it, unless and until, you know, we formally reject it. How binding, how constricting as a result of these arrangements, one or the other, can these treaties be, even if, as you say, the United States Senate won't adopt?
Well, let's discuss the Vienna Convention very briefly. This is something called the Vienna Convention on Treaties, established in 1969. And among a lot of other things, it says that once that you sign a treaty, you're under an obligation not to try to defeat the treaty's object and purpose. Well, what does object and purpose mean? Unfortunately, object and purpose is interpreted by the State Department's lawyers, so it really has no clear meaning. The U.S. right now, under treaties that it has not that it has signed but not ratified, appropriates money. It takes or does not take policy action in support of particular treaties that the Senate has never approved. So treaties like this can mean a good deal for the United States in policy terms, even leaving aside their broader judicial impact. I think it's high time that the Senate and the House, and hopefully the President, work together to define under U.S. law the exact meaning of object and purpose, to clarify the status of the Vienna Convention within the United States, and to do a number of other things that would clean up the U.S. treaty-making system and make it impossible for the President, any President, to commit the United States to anything by way of a treaty before the Senate has an obligation to take their vote on it.
Right.
I think that would be a very healthy thing
eminently
for the United
sensible.
States.
Indeed. Ted Broman, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for the work you're doing at the Heritage Foundation and for sharing your insights on these really important issues, which unfortunately are not getting the kind of attention, apart from your own, that they deserve. We'll look forward to visiting with you about them in the near future. Next up, we have Andy McCarthy. We'll get his take on this debate and seeming fresh outbreaks of spring fever. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to the Gospel.
I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. The high point of our week. Andy McCarthy joins us for his take on, among other things, this post-mortem on the debate and what was said and, importantly, what was not said. Andy McCarthy, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Frank, great to be here as always.
We had a debate last night, as I've talked about with several of our guests, that seemed to be an effort, in important respects at least, of Obama to try to sound like Romney on big issues like the strength of our military, and Romney trying to sound a lot like Obama on many other points, specific points of foreign policy, from Afghanistan to the Arab Spring and Syria. What is it that you took away from that event, and what might have been missed as a result by the electorate?
Well, I think the debate was pointless for Romney, and when you engage in something that's pointless, I think the chances are you're going to hurt yourself in the long run, and I think he probably has done that. You know, obviously he thinks things are trending in his direction, and he didn't want to make a mistake, and the easiest way not to make a mistake is to be kind of like a fighter in a boxing match who just clinches for the whole fight and avoids any real exchanges. But it can't be logically that Obama is the worst president in the modern history of the United States because his policies obviously are so wayward, and that it's a brilliant strategy on Romney's part not to have any distance between what he wants to do and what Obama has done. I mean, both things can't be
true.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think Obama, I think maybe in electorally in the long run, especially since we're only 2 weeks away from the election, this will prove to have been a big nothing in terms of as an event that has any impact on the election. But I think that I think Romney missed a real opportunity to lay out the disaster that is the Obama foreign policy record. And the fact that he didn't do it suggests to me a real lack of confidence in his own vision. And for those who say that, you know, this is a wise strategy to employ at this stage of the campaign, tactically, I just wonder if we would have had a President Reagan, if Ronald Reagan had been afraid to lay out the disaster that was the foreign policy record of Jimmy Carter. I think a lot of history might have been very different had he shied away like Romney shied away last night.
Yeah. And Andy, I think that's a very telling point, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I wonder, too, kind of corollary to that is whether we would have had a Reagan presidency.
Right.
Even if Reagan had been elected, without the mandate that he received from the American people for a fundamental course correction by starkly laying out what the choice was. And this is what I guess is most painful to me. We talk about this with you each week, and it's, as I say, the greatest of privileges to do so. But you, among many of our guests, are documenting assiduously the things that need to be corrected and the stakes if we fail to correct them. And I want to get into one of those now with you, this whole Arab Spring business, about which you've written brilliantly, of course, in Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy. But to hear Mitt Romney talking about it, it sounded an awful lot like he was good with what Obama is trying to do. He'd just like to do more of it or maybe do it better, have a comprehensive strategy for doing it. But essentially, it's more elections, it's more economic assistance, it's more engagement, it would appear, with the very people that are of such concern to thee and me, specifically these Islamists.
Yeah, Frank, I must say I fell out of my chair when, with everything that we've seen about Libya in the last month, Romney's take on it last night seemed to be the following quote: "It's wonderful that Libya seems to be making some progress." I mean, you just at a certain point just have to throw up your hands. And I must say, this isn't just an indictment of Romney. It's really an indictment of the conservative commentariat. For a month, we've seen, I think rightly so, what happened in Benghazi turned into a national scandal. You know, people like Newt Gingrich and others have repeated this, saying things like, you know, nobody was killed in Watergate, to sort of show the wages of the comparative scandals. And last night, Romney not only decided not to take Obama on about Benghazi, but also to essentially suggest that his take on Libya is things are going pretty well there. And I expected all of these conservative commentators who for weeks have been telling us about what a disaster Benghazi is, to say, how could Romney have taken that position? And yet they all seem to be saying, gee, what a brilliant strategy not to engage him on Benghazi, to look, sober and presidential. And, look, we know, just to take one particular, that we had forces an hour away from a siege that went on for 6 hours. Obama got a call. He knew in real time the disaster that was going on there. And not only do we have a situation where we left our people without adequate protection to begin with, he didn't call in the military when they were under siege. Now, that is the most indefensible thing I can remember a president doing I don't want to go back, as long as I can remember. Why we have this second to none in the history of the planet military, if we're not going to use it when our own people are under the kind of siege they were in Benghazi, is mind-boggling, and Romney chose not to engage on that. And the conservative commentary, it seems to say, hey, that's cool. Yeah. Well, you know, not me.
Yeah, not you, indeed, Andy McCarthy, author of, as I've mentioned, not only the marvelous new book, e-book, Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy, but also Willful Blindness and the Grand Jihad, former federal prosecutor and one of the driving forces behind the marvelous work that's done at National Review Online, also now with the David Horowitz Freedom Center in Philadelphia. Let me ask you this, Andy. There's reporting coming out of a number of different quarters. Fox News has picked it up. Aaron Klein at WorldNet Daily, our friend and colleague Claire Lopez at RadicalIslam.org, that what might have been afoot in Benghazi that actually makes all the more important the points that you've just made about the need to address the problem, to have the president held accountable by it, for it, and of course the role that the military was playing or not playing in this case, perhaps because the president had to off to Las Vegas for his fundraiser, but there seems to be growing evidence that what Ambassador Stevens was involved in was a kind of well, for want of a better term, Iran-Contra arms shipment program on steroids, not to the Iranian regime this time, but to Al-Qaeda and other Islamists in Syria. Do you credit that thesis? And if so, how is it that this is not something that we are really seeing people held to account for?
Well, I credit it insofar as that it warrants not only investigation, but immediate investigation, because, you know, listening to the debate last night, it sounds like that effort is ongoing. There seemed to be a lot of common ground last night, but one thing that was certainly common ground on is the need, supposedly, to arm the quote-unquote opposition in Syria, which is to say the Muslim Brotherhood and its jihadist affiliates in this endeavor, which would include Al-Qaeda, just as it did in Libya. So it's not only urgent that we get to the bottom of it in principle, just if it had been a historical incident, but it's especially urgent that we do it now, because this is an effort that very well could be ongoing if this, in fact, is what is happening. And it's dismaying, to put it mildly, that I really don't think that this is going to be looked at. It may never be looked at the way it ought to be looked at, because there's too many people on both sides of the political aisle who seem to have common ground on it, but it's certainly not going to be looked at in a serious way in any event until after the election is over.
Well, and or until it really blows up on us big time,
which
when we have surfaced air missiles, man-pad surfaced air missiles and the like apparently migrating into the hands of terrorist organizations, you can bet that that will in fact be the case. Andy McCarthy, as always, thank you for your time today and for your superb work at National Review and elsewhere. We look forward to visiting with you again next week, and in the meantime, be well. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.